Well, I started my journey about 47 years ago in all kind of alternative health projects and everything. And that was back when it wasn't very popular. It was kind of the fringe stuff. You know, I was doing enemas and juicing and all that stuff when it's like, what's that? But, you know, you get in and out of it because there's nobody around to talk about it and there's no forums and there was no internet. So, things have changed a great deal. But I got into the nursing profession and couldn't do anything with that because I won't even go there. And then about 10 years ago, I got into homeopathic practice, and that's what I do now, and try and impact the lives of a lot of mostly children, but we do all ages. And so you can't really make a difference even with homeopathic detox unless you address the nutrition. And the nutrition is so confusing out there. And when I discovered Rita Marie, and I found her potlucks because I live in this area, it was like drinking from a fire hose. So, and she fills in a lot of the gaps that are nowhere else. And of course, they don't touch on genetics and, you know, a lot of the other things that she covers. So I'm just really blessed to be able to be working with her and exchanging ideas because, you know, it takes everybody's information to put together the pieces to make the big picture. You know, it's all the little puzzle pieces together. And she's kind of like the cement between everything. So without further ado, Rita Marie. Because I'm
happy with you. I don't need your mic. Thank you. So now I get the pleasure of introducing someone who, the way I met was through her book, almost 20 years ago, The Body Ecology Diet. And about 5 or 6 years ago, I got the pleasure of meeting her in person at a conference. And we just really hit it off, just the geekiness back and forth and our whole attitude about healthcare. And we just became friends back then. And Donna Gates is an amazing woman. She has written, I don't know how many books. She's written a book on autism. She's written a book on aging. She's written a book, The Body Ecology Diet, which is what put her in the sphere. She was the first person to be talking about the microbiome in a public way. And before it was called The Microbiome, she's hosted several summits, and she just told me she has another one coming up, which I will be speaking on, and I'm excited. And she just inspires and educates. And what I love about Donna is her dedication. She will research and she will look into things and she will find better ways. She's not about fanfare. She's not about fluff. She's the real deal. Like, she knows her stuff and she researches. And she's going to give you an amazing presentation today. And without further ado, Donna Gates. I got that sunshine in my pocket. Yay! All right, it's all yours, honey.
Thank you. I'm going to use this computer here. And I guess I'll start off explaining. Let's see, hold on a second. Let me get back to the beginning. Why this talk? I could tell you a little bit about myself and my history and all, but it's kind of a long history. I've been doing this work I started in 1990, so it's a long time. But I was sick way before that as a teenager, and so I studied in college to be a dietitian and went to work in a VA hospital just before I graduated, and I thought, this is not the right field for me. I hated the hospital environment, but I never stopped learning about health and trying everything, so... you know, with the goal to get well myself, but, you know, I'm just kind of a natural-born teacher, so I would attract people that had the same problems I had, and then I would share what I was learning, and here I am today, and I'm really into genes. Like, I get a little addicted to something every once in a while, and obsessed, I guess you could say, but I do have genes for that, and... But, you know, because for years I've been... body ecology is a way of life. It is not a diet. And although the book was called The Body Ecology Diet, because I wrote it for people who had candidiasis, and I wanted people to... which is a serious, serious problem, by the way, and it still is today. And, you know, doctors are constantly seeing that yeast are playing a really serious role. I mean, they're seeing that people have antibodies for yeast and that they definitely have an issue with it, but they don't get anything about it. And it's a super serious infection. You never really get rid of it. You have to keep it under control. But that book, written years ago, is still very, very accurate today. So it still sells. It actually sells more books today than it did for a long, you know, all these years. But you know, it's just, it's a book, and you can only say so much in a book. But body ecology isn't a diet. It's actually a way of life. And it's the reason it's a way of life versus a diet is it's not like the paleo diet or the ketogenic diet or vegan diet, whatever. It is based on universal laws. And these laws are priceless. Because I've been able to figure so many things out. About 17 years ago, I started working with moms whose children had autism. And I didn't know anything about autism. I'm learning as I was helping them. But I did know those seven universal laws, and I used them to find answers. And one of them we're going to go into in more detail today is to show you how it works. But, you know, so the moms formed themselves into a group, and then, you know, they're very internet savvy. So before you know it, many, many people, we had about 2,000 people, you know, in our program, which they named themselves Bedrock, which stands for Body Ecology Diet Recovering Our Kids. So these were the first children to ever get well from autism. And within 2 years, all the what were then called DAN doctors started, you know, they would take their children to these doctors, excellent doctors. Many of them had their own children were autistic also. So they started noticing that we were, you know, dealing with a yeast infection that almost all children today are born with a yeast infection. And you need to know that right from the get-go so you can help that baby overthrow that infection by building a strong immune system, which is all about the gut. So we were also fixing the gut and helping open up the detoxification pathways. I taught the moms about enemas, and that was huge for helping the kids. They even got to the point a lot of the kids would bring their enema bucket to their mother to ask for an enema because they felt so much better. So, you know, other people began adopting a lot of our things that we did, and now many, many thousands of children have recovered from autism, but you don't hear about that. You just hear, and I used to speak at autism conferences and all. I don't do that anymore because I'm so tired of explaining to parents talking about autism because it's so preventable. 100% of the time, for 17 years now, we've prevented autism over and over and over again. And it's just so hard to get that message out there for some reason. But I'm very excited about the genes, because I think within 5 years, we will be testing children young, like even at birth. We should actually get their genes tested at birth and start letting the parents know where their genetic risk factors are, and that will help. But I wish I could talk just about autism, but anyway. There's a whole lot to know. Like it's a great, you know, field to look into because it's a field that's more advanced than anywhere else. Like if you go to an autism conference like Autism One in May in Chicago, you'll see the best, brightest minds with the most advanced knowledge there right now. So anyway, so body ecology is based on seven universal laws, and that's just an example of you know, the usefulness of those. But you know, I'm talking about unlocking your body's potential for healing, and then so these seven principles that I was talking about, I'll just quickly read them. There's the principle of expansion and contraction, and that's really the yin-yang principle that Chinese medicine is based on. But what we're always striving for when we cook a meal or, you know, try to bring the body back to a healthy stage, we're striving for balance. And some foods are naturally very balanced, and some of them are too expansive and too contractive, and it's all, you know, that's like a whole fascinating conversation right there. But principle of acid and alkaline is another principle. I was macrobiotic for 8 years. Went to Japan, studied with Lima Osawa, who started the macrobiotic movement. And when I graduated from her academy, she said, take the truth about macrobiotics to the world. And I had no idea what she was talking about until I got back to the US and I saw why all the things that were wrong. And that's when I met Dr. William Crook, who'd written The Yeast Connection. And he was a dear man, but his diet wasn't strict enough. And so I took all this, you know, information, knowledge that I gathered and came up with the Body Ecology Diet for candidiasis, so for yeast infections. But, you know, I said to myself, well, those are two principles used in macrobiotics, yin and yang and Chinese medicine, which I studied, and studied acupuncture and all that. And then there's the acid alkaline principle. But I started thinking, there's got to be more principles that we can use to apply to healing to find answers. And then, so the others, the principle of uniqueness was one, which is why I watched all these fads come and go, you know, raw movement, which, and they always end up, when you can tell they're about to be over when everybody's raw, but they're eating tons of sugar. And they all are like that. So right now there's paleo, which is very body ecology, and versions of that. And then there's the ketogenic diet, which I'm about to show you why that doesn't work. And for everybody. And then the principle of cleansing is super important. Food combining is, you know, so many people. I mean, I'd say everybody that comes to you will have gut problems. So this food combining law is very important for those people. And so that's, you know, it's not complicated to learn. I highly recommend you look into that. And then there's the 80-20 principle, which is a principle that I use all the time, which I'll probably mention some more about it later on. And then probably my most favorite one is the principle of step-by-step. So I've sat in hundreds and hundreds of hours and online trainings and conferences and, you know, learning all this stuff I could about genes. And, of course, like many of you, it was so over my head in the beginning, just like when I started studying about hormones. I thought, oh, my gosh, it's so complicated. Will I ever learn this? But you just hang out with it, and you just keep absorbing, and some stuff sticks, and eventually more and more. But the principle of so what I noticed is that I'm sitting in this room with a lot of really smart people. They're medical doctors. They had tons of biochemistry, which I didn't have. Back when I graduated in 1968, they didn't have biochemistry like they do today. And so I have had to train myself a lot of it. But, you know, these people here sitting there, they did know this, and they were completely confused. And also, usually the way everything's presented, you're just being thrown a bunch of genes, and there's not a system, a way of making sense of any of that. So I sat there and I thought, And then the principle of step-by-step came to mind, and I started thinking, you know, you need to go to first grade before you go to high school, right? So let me use the principle of step-by-step to make sense of this and be able to teach people so they can go out the door ready to, you know, they're able to start really helping people right away. So that's what we're going to go into today. And the principle of uniqueness, I don't think I'll stay on this slide very long, but you know that our genes make us unique, but so do the current conditions. Like, you have diabetes right now, or you overweight, or you pregnant, or you 6 years old, or you 36 years, you know, what physical conditions we have, where we live, we're living in a hot climate or a cold climate, you know, circumstances in life, like, did you grow up on a farm and you got sprayed when your dad sprayed the, you know, crops with a lot of poison and you have all that in you? I think blood type is very important. I have a whole chapter in the book on blood type. Peter's father, James D'Adamo, was actually somebody I went with when I went to as a sick person myself years ago, and I learned about blood type 42 years ago. So naturally, I've been asking a lot of people over time, what's their blood type? When I started working with the autistic children, 85% of them are blood type A, and many, many people who come to you for help will be blood type A. So O is stronger. There are not as many children with autism that are blood type O, even fewer are blood type B, that have a stronger immune system and less likely to have autoimmune conditions and so on. And protein, exercise, things like that. There's a lot in your genes. For example, A's lack an enzyme in the small intestine called alkaline phosphatase, so they don't digest proteins and fats very well. And then, of course, the microbiome, which, like, we could be here for 4 days talking about that. But in this program I'm about to show you, in every single category that we're going to go over, I always look at the role that the microbiome plays, because they're always there, because they have their genes that are affecting our genes. And then even your belief system, like every single one of us had stuff happen to us when we were young, and we formed these core limiting beliefs. I'm not pretty, I'm not smart, I'm not special, I'm not, all these things, whatever they are, that we formed are actually very much suppressing us. And I like to, when I'm working with somebody, listen between the lines of what they are telling me. I do have a master's degree in counseling. One of the things I learned and still remember is that you don't just listen to what the person says, it's listen between the lines of what they're not saying. So I do that when I'm doing consultations. I listen to things, clues, you know, that tell me about that person. So, and then they might have injuries. Maybe they, you know, had a motorcycle accident or fell somewhere and out of a tree when they were a child, and they have the brain, you know, is inflamed, or anyway, they have autism, whatever. So those are things that make us unique. So there's a lot of factors to consider. And then, of course, there's a lot of genes, like 20-something thousand. Don't seem to know exactly just yet, but... And then it isn't just about the gene, like MTHFR is the celebrity gene, but there's other genes that are impacting that one gene. So it gets really, really confusing out there, but it doesn't have to be, because there is a way to learn to make it, you know, so you can remember it, or learn it, I guess. So as I mentioned before, every single one of the trillions of microbes in our gut, whether they're good guys or bad guys, they have their own set of genes. It's really, really difficult for scientists to take a group of bacteria, let's say your bifidus bacteria, and say, oh, they have these bifidus have these genes. That's because they're constantly switching genes with each other. Like if we could do that, and you know, you had the brown eyes I wanted, and you know, you had the height I wanted or whatever, you know, and we went over and we switched our genes around. That we can't do that, obviously, but they do it all the time. It's kind of like a big gene swapping party going down on inside of us all the time. So it's going to be a long, long time before scientists really understand. It's more complicated to understand the microbiome than it will be to understand outer space. But nevertheless, there's some important things we know. For example, the genes in our gut control our clock genes. That, you know, clock genes are your rhythm and how you sleep and everything. They do everything, every single thing you can think of. They are playing a key role. And there's only 23,000-ish genes that we have, way less actually. And we can't run our body on 23,000 genes. So the scientists realized that most of the heavy lifting is taking place, the microbes in our gut are doing the work. So you've got to always take into consideration the microbiome in every single situation. So getting to the principle of step-by-step, my favorite principle. So, you know, years ago I thought, okay, let's look at this principle. And, you know, it's the principle of time. Like things advance in tiny little steps. Sometimes we certainly age in little increments, and sometimes we get sick in little increments and get well that way. You can get sick literally overnight, but practically. But anyway, so universe for the most part advances in tiny steps. And then I thought, well, how would you apply that principle for healing? Well, first of all, you have to start somewhere, right? Whatever journey you're going on, there's a beginning point. So where would you start? If you're going to learn about genes or help somebody, where would you start? And then, you know, I was always asking the universe for ideas. And so what came up, or I feel like I was sort of given this idea, that, well, first of all, you'd have to create energy. Because if somebody doesn't have any energy, that's it. The game's over right there. Like, I'll do consultations, and I'll look at this person. They're not sleeping. They don't have any energy. Or their energy's wired. And so whatever, you've got to look at that. So so what I did was I created a program, and it's called Butterfly Genomics. And it's based on these you can call them buckets or categories that the genes are grouped into. So I'm going to go over that today because I think it'll be really valuable if you've got all these genes to learn and they're kind of all over the place. How would you study them so that you can, not waste your time learning things that aren't relevant, or, how can you organize this material so you can learn it, basically? So I created a program called Butterfly Genomics, certain genes that belong together, in my opinion, are in these buckets, and the buckets, really, when you look at those, you're really looking at your client or patient's potential for having problems, their ability to heal, and so on. So there's not that many of them. For example, then there's some related to nutrition, and those would be where you would look at your vitamin and mineral deficiencies. Also, vitamin and minerals are really, really important to look at because they are your cofactors. They activate the genes, particularly the B vitamins, zinc, selenium. If you get Ben Lynch's Seeking Health, his pathway planner, he has the cofactors for these important genes listed on there. He also has what would inhibit that gene and so on, what activates it and supports it. So it's good to buy that and own that. There's important cofactors, and that's in your vitamins and minerals usually. So here's the action plan. You're going to create the energy to heal. You're going to conquer infections and inflammation. If you look at the genes around that, you're going to correct digestion, so the genes around that, and you're going to cleanse out the toxins. Now, if you look at that, you're well on your way to helping people. For years, I've done consultations, and people sign up to do the consultation, and every time they hang up, you can tell. I mean, you can listen to the recording on the end. They're kind of blown away with how much I've helped them. But all I'm doing is following this format, basically. And nobody has been able to help them that much because they don't know this format. So in the energy category or bucket, sleep and stress and fats are there because we get our energy from fats. If you don't sleep and have sleeping problems, you're not going to have any energy. And stress is, if the person's wasting a lot of their energy because they're all stressed out because the genes related to that, then they're not going to have energy. So there's sort of sub-buckets under energy. So inflammation and infection, inflammation, immunity, that's where you look at the person's risk factor for low immunity, for example. Yeah, they have candidiasis, for example. And then digestion is a bucket. Cleansing is a bucket, detoxifying and cleansing. What is their ability to eliminate toxins, vitamins, minerals? And then I have a category called Know Your Client, the genes for knowing your client. So let's look at that first. Who are you working with? I like to look at this category right off the bat because it tells me right away so much about that person. So much amazing information is hidden in the DNA about who they are, and they need to even know who they are. If it's their child, it helps a whole lot if they understand their child's personality, why they behave a certain way. So that's very much in the genes. So here's just an example, because I have only an hour. I thought I was going to have a bunch of hours. Then I found out a couple of days, 2 days ago, it was an hour. So I'm just going to breeze through all these. But here are genes that absolutely are related to a personality behavior. There's the DRD2 genes, which are about dopamine. I feel like I'm talking because I'm too fast. So am I talking too fast? Is it okay? Because I feel like so much I want to show you before my time is up. But the DRD2 genes are about dopamine, but there isn't just one or two. There's tons and tons of DRD2 genes. So what I like to do is look at a bunch of them. And if you see a lot of, say, heterozygous ones, or maybe one or two are red or three or four, you kind of generalize and think, wow, this person's really got an issue with dopamine. And I see, it's amazing how many people have problems with the dopamine, DRD2, which is dopamine receptor. So why are we so addicted to things? Because we're always needing to get our dopamine up. That's one of the most common genes I always see in people. And they have a whole bunch of them, by the way. So oxytocin, I like to know about oxytocin because it tells you how empathetic that person is. You know, do they pick up people? Or they have some of the oxytocin genes means the person's like real analytical. They have trouble feeling. So talk to them differently because of that. That's their personality. So I won't stay any longer, too much longer in that. But well, actually, even the last one, the CBD genes, they're interesting because, you know, people that are wired, because they have COMP, for example, and MAOA variants that are making them more stressed out, full of anxiety, they're going to be drawn to CBD. I think a lot of millennials are really, really hooked on it. But there's some genes that will tell the CBD, you know, the stuff that you take, the healthy version of pot, by looking at the genes, you can see if that person is really going to get in trouble by continuing to take even CBD, which, you know, doesn't have the THC in it, healthier than pot, helping them relax, but how long can they take it? Or they only can use a strain of, so with CBD, you only need to be on a strain for maybe 10 days or 2 weeks, and then you will switch to another strain, or soon it won't work for you anymore. That's a big deal in the autism community because it helps those kids a lot. But, you know, after a little bit of time, that particular brand that they're taking isn't working any longer. So there's real interesting information in the CBD genes. You know, depression is a serious problem today. You can look and see, you know, does this person have a tendency to have a lot of anxiety and be depressed? That's all in the genes. Of course, there's a lot of things besides the genes, like what kind of living, like what's their, does this person come from a family that's just crazy and they're trying to survive? This has socioeconomic factors. Have they been traumatized, like, you know, raped when they were a little child or something? You know, sometimes, you know, there's a family history. And these are things you can kind of, you know, you're working with somebody, you don't just want to get all this information in one sitting, but hopefully you'll continue to work with somebody for a while until you really help them. So these kind of things can all be playing a role in depression, but there are 44 genes to date, as of today, that they've discovered are related to depression. So you see, we're very prone to depression. And with the DRD2 genes that I mentioned, we're very prone to depression. You know, dopamine is flat. So life is flat for those people. They think they're depressed. They go get a medication. You'll see in a minute why that's not a good idea. The BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, that I bet Tom talked about that. That's a really important gene to look at. It's a very powerful little protein, a little gene, that stimulates your production of new brain cells. And it's really important for strengthening the brain cells you do have. And it increases your brain's plasticity and is very vital for learning and memory. And if you've got low levels of BDF, those are the people that are going to be depressed. They can have bipolar. They can even be suicide. So what lowers BDNF, diet's critical for this. And so if the person's under a lot of stress, so you can look at the stress genes. If they're drawn to sugar, like I have a category on diet, and in there you can see the foods that people are drawn to and so on. If they're living in a situation where they're older, let's say, and they're living alone, their partner died, or if they've had mercury, a lot of mercury, that's all that's going to lower BDNF. But then there's a lot of things to do to elevate, keep your BDNF levels at a healthy level. Intermittent fasting is a great one. It's great for a lot of things. And, you know, being involved, sleeping well, you know, I think everybody, whatever your spiritual path is, it's different for all of us, but it's important to be on one. So here's the create energy bucket that I mentioned, and everything creates energy. Everything you do that's positive creates energy, and a lot of things bring the energy of that person down. You can look at the mitochondria genes. Those are important. They're in our program. But another gene that's really important is ACAT. Very, very important one, because so we either get our energy from sugar or we get it from the fats we eat. So let's say you're on this diet and you're eating all these healthy fats and you're thinking, you know, I should be having all this energy, but not if you have ACAT SNPs, because, you know, that is the gene that pulls, where you're utilizing carnitine to pull those fats into the cell, because if the fats can't get into the cell, you're not going to have any energy from fats. And so those people often have sugar. You know, fat doesn't work for them too well. But there's others. I'm just skimming quickly through this. Now I'm trying to find my mouse. So the sleep genes are really, really critical. Rita Marie and I were talking to the group we were having lunch with. I have two copies of AA and AT. And that means I don't turn serotonin, you know, the pathway, serotonin turns into melatonin, not for us. So then you know how important sleep is, and you can say to the person, you really should take a little bit of melatonin, even just 1 milligram, so that person feels sleepy, because they won't feel sleepy. And, you know, some people say, oh, I read melatonin is really bad for you. Melatonin is fantastic for us. It's protective against cancer. It's great for not aging. There's nothing really wrong with melatonin, and I've watched, you know, I probably looked at hundreds of studies, and I, you know, have my advanced fellowship from American Academy of Anti-Aging Medicine. I take all these hundreds and hundreds of hours of hormone stuff, which melatonin is a hormone. There's nothing bad about melatonin, so please use it if you see someone has this gene. And there's another one, too, after AANAT called AS-MT, but that, anytime anything ends in an MT, you know it's about methylation, but they don't report, 23andMe does not report on that, which is why we're in the process of getting our own chip, meaning with the genes that we want. So you would order this kit, not from 23andMe, but from us, and it has a lot of more genes on it. So, but CLOCK, PER, GABA, GAD1 is the gene that takes glutamate and turns it into GABA. Those are the kind of things you want to look at. Lots of people have COMP. It's super, super common because it was a survival gene. Our ancestors survived because they had this gene. So obviously, we so many of us have it. Well, it's the gene that keeps you, if you hear something and you get like really alert, dopamine goes up, you get stressed, you know, and your adrenaline goes up and noradrenaline, and then, you know, then you think, well, I don't think I heard anything really. It's probably okay. If you have the COMP gene, you would have stayed very alert for a long time, and whatever that was in the bushes that was, you know, stalking you, you'd stay very alert, and if you saw it, then you'd run away, and it didn't eat you, so you went ahead and reproduced and had other people. But if you were that kind of person that, you know, thought, it's nothing, and they calmed down right away, then the thing jumped out and ate them, they wouldn't be here any longer. So they wouldn't have, you know, passed their genes on. So this is a really super common gene. You'll see it all the time. And the BD, I love this gene. BD9 is super important because a lot of people have restless legs. You know, they move all night long. They can't get a good night's sleep. There's tons of research on restless leg. But then, you know, like for that person's usually very deficient in iron. So they need to eat foods with iron, like liver, for example, at least once a week. But other ones related to sleep are B12. You want to check your methylation because that's where your neurotransmitters get made. And then, ammonia, let me jump down to that because I'm a huge ammonia fan. I mean, I'm a big fan of studying ammonia because ammonia is a very dangerous neurotoxin, and it's a huge problem for most people, and they don't even know it because there's different ways our genes make ammonia, and if you don't digest your protein, you're ending up with a lot of ammonia in the gut, and it's a brain toxin, it's a nervous system toxin. And so it's affecting your sleep, obviously, because you have to use something called BH4, there's a gene for that. So the BH4 is used to mop up the ammonia, but you need that BH4 to make neurotransmitters like serotonin to help us fall asleep. So that's a really important thing that's connected to sleep. And of course, calcium and magnesium. You know, Rita Marie's mentioned the TRPM6, which is probably the most researched magnesium gene. So calcium and magnesium are both important. And then, believe it or not, a whole lot of people can't sleep because they have histamine problems. So I like to check the HNMT and DAO, which has a new name, by the way. It's called now, I think it's called ACOT or something. But I always forget the new name. But fortunately, you don't have to remember this stuff because it's all there for you. It's there. But huge research. A lot of times, what I would do for this is, let's say, you know, the person wakes up too early. I'll have them keep holy basil by their bedside, and if they wake up, to take two of those holy basil by a company like Gaia Herbs, for example, swallow that and just lie back there. And next thing you know, they've gotten 2 more hours or so of sleep, which makes a huge difference. Because holy basil, it calms down cortisol, which has also sprung up, most likely, and also it's great for histamine, lowering histamine too. So the Butterfly program is very much a lot of epigenetics, but I don't have time to go into any of that. So, but anyway, but this is an example right there. What can you do that's easy to do that makes a huge difference to a person? So stress genes, like oxytocin that I mentioned, these here, DRG2, I kind of covered those already. So now, inflammation, that's a huge problem. Everybody knows that underneath anything wrong, whether you're looking at a child with autism, you have diabetes, you have cancer, anything, you have a lot of inflammation in the body, inflammation in the brain, and so on. So what about, we have to conquer that inflammation. And how you do that, most of all, is infections cause are the number one cause of inflammation. But, glyphosate, for example, and so on, poisons, toxins, they cause inflammation too, obviously. But these genes right here, TNF-alpha, and CRP and interleukin-1 and interleukin-6. Interleukin-6 activates CRP. So if you have these, your person you're working with or you yourself have these inflammation genes, a lot of variants there, controlling inflammation is going to be really, really difficult for you. So again, you want to learn what would you do for that, to help that person. I don't have time to go into that, but so our body, just the very running of the body, makes free radicals. Like, one of the free radicals we make is superoxide, but it's negated or like broken down and turned into a more less harmless subject with this enzyme called superoxide dismutase. Anytime something ends in an ACE, A-S-E, it is an enzyme. So this superoxide dismutase enzyme comes along and negates the superoxide poison free radical. Then catalase gene, turns the hydrogen peroxide that the superoxide dismutase makes, catalase is right there, and turns that into oxygen and water, which are healthy. So there's this little thing, like where they're supporting each other, but what if you've got SNPs there? Then you need to know that. And then the NOS genes, there's 3 or 4 of them that are really critical to look at. They're really, really important for, because we need, that stands for nitric oxide, and we need nitric oxide. If you don't have enough of it, your hair is going to fall out. And you need it for fighting infections in the body, and you need it for healthy circulation, nitric oxide. But if you have SNPs there, and you're not making enough nitric oxide, then you've got a problem, too. So, again, not enough time. But so candida, fungus, and viruses in our body and bacteria are major reasons we have inflammation in our body. And what I do want to say is, again, I mentioned before, there's a whole bunch to know about candidiasis. It's, I think, I don't know if I created a PowerPoint recently, a really long one on Candida, and I think we're about to release that pretty soon. But, you know, if you follow the work, you know, I'm always teaching this stuff, and then next year, I'm just going to start doing lots of podcasts. Some are just going to be me teaching, and a lot of great guests that I'll have on. But I just feel like people don't understand what they're dealing with yeast. Every single child with autism, 100% of the time, is born with candidiasis. And their mothers know it, and they have it too. But the thing is, we need to assume every baby has it so that when they're born, we can start doing the things to help them throw that off right away. And you can do that when the baby's really young. And that's a major, major factor. The yeast are producing huge chemicals all the time, nasty chemicals like acetaldehyde and other things, other substances that suppress the immune system. So it's very, very hard to overcome it. But there's, of course, a fix for that. And, you know, viruses, like we just launched last week, our new product, it's called Ecophage, and phages are amazing. You're going to start hearing a lot more about them. They're tiny, tiny viruses, beneficial, good viruses. You know, everything that's good is bad. There's a good version of Clostridia and bad version of Clostridia. Good yeast, good, you know, Saccharomyces boulardii is a good yeast. And then there's Candida, which is the bad yeast. Same with viruses. So this phages are tiny, tiny little viruses. They're way smaller than bacteria. And they are like a SWAT team that's specifically trained to go after specific bacteria. So some of them are trained to just attack the E. coli, for example, in your gut. And so what they do is a real amazingly simple little organism, but it has this shaft, and the shaft penetrates right down into the cell wall of the bacteria, the bad gut. Let's say it's E. coli as an example. It penetrates that E. coli, and then it starts injecting its DNA into the cell. And then that cell has all these nutrients in it, so it starts feeding that reproducing more and more and more of the virus, the beneficial virus. Soon it blows up and bursts. And now trillions of the viruses are out there running around looking for more E. coli to get rid of. So it's a pretty extraordinary thing. They even have a wonderful treatment, you probably haven't heard of it, called RIGVIR, R-I-G-V-I-R, that people fly to Latvia to get, because of course our country doesn't even tell you about it. But it's another phage that kills tumors, particularly lymphoma, but other cancers too. And they've even had people literally at death's door come there and get completely well. Because the same thing, it's a phage, and it can, it goes after the stem cells. So the reason people's cancer comes back is the treatments never get the stem cells. They hide. So you're just getting rid of the daughter cells. You've got to get that stem cell. So the phages can do that. The other thing phages do that are really, really important, I wish I had more time just to draw on this one subject, archaea. Have you heard about archaea? Not too many people? Okay, so in our gut, there's a microbe. It's not a bacteria. They now realize they thought it was a bacteria, but they realize it's very different. It has a completely different cell wall, and antibiotics don't destroy it. So that's the nice thing about phage. They are the new antibiotic. They can go after these bacteria when the person's antibiotic resistant, and they're very effective the way they work. So they also can kill archaea. So archaea, ancient organisms, they're thought to be, our current theory of evolution is that a bacteria swallowed an archaea, and the archaea was real, active, and the bacteria weren't too active, and they swallowed it, engulfed it, and began to reproduce, and that's how all life began. So they've always been around. But they cause constipation in the gut. And a lot of times, Clostridia difficile, for example, which everybody thinks is a diarrhea, you know, they get Clostridia difficile after they take an antibiotic, becomes resistant to antibiotic, the person gets diarrhea. They think, you know, it's a bacteria, but phages, I mean, archaea can cause constipation with the Clostridia difficile too. So Clostridia difficile can also be constipation. But the archaea, they aren't destroyed by antibiotics. That's why the phage is so important. And they cause constipation because they take anything we eat, which, you know, when we eat food, we get hydrogen in our body, and they take the hydrogen and they make methane gas. And they make it up in the digestive tract where you don't know it's even there, but it's causing constipation. So people with lifelong constipation have probably had this archaea in their gut their whole entire life. And when you start, well, the Atrantil, which I've noticed you've got in your bag, is for archaea. Also, you know those, let's see, what do they call them? Like O noodle and Miracle noodle, the noodles that are made out of a yam called glucomannan, that helps control archaea. And so do the phages. The Ecophage also does that. So, you know, it doesn't just work in the gut. Like I had, for a couple of years, this ongoing lung cough thing. And I even twice took antibiotics, which I don't mind taking because, like, you know, we have our cultured vegetables with the Plantarum, and it's not Plantarum is not destroyed by antibiotics. And so I didn't have any problem, but it didn't work. And then I started taking the phage, and then my lung problem cleared up because it goes through the whole body. It's fantastic for urinary tract infections and even probably they're looking at it now for Lyme disease, but it's just something really, really to look into. And viruses can be good and viruses can be bad, but the bad ones are causing inflammation. So another category, another bucket is correcting digestion. We're real big on that. Here's the genes you want to look at, including serotonin receptors. FUT2, I wish I could tell you about FUT2. It's just so important. Like people say, here's what people will tell you if you go study for most people. They'll say, well, you know, FUT2, if you've got, there's one gene that, so it's also about two things. It's about gut and feeding the microbiome because we all have these different, like I'm an A, so I have A sugar, blood type A sugar, that I'm secreting into my gut, mouth, tears, sweat, and the bacteria, the sugar is feeding the bacteria in my gut, the bacteria in my mouth. If you have SNPs with the food too, then you're not feeding those. That sugar isn't feeding them because you don't have that sugar there. So it's really important to know that this is a very important gene to know because that person is going to have trouble feeding the bacteria in their gut, particularly the bifidus. Now, that's what you'll hear if you look into food too. But here's something you won't hear is that at the very, very beginning of our life, when we're born, for the first 6 weeks, bifidus infantis predominates, is, you know, basically controlling what's happening in the gut. And then other bifidus are there too, and they're super important because, you know, nature does things in a step-by-step order, and these bifidus come first, and they're important to keep in your gut throughout your life, but they're almost non-existent in an elderly person. Well, if I know that someone has a FUT2 SNP and they're not feeding their bacteria, they need to take bifidus and other prebiotics like the inulin that we have, the Echo Bloom, it's called. You know, take that, like put some in a bottle of water and sip on that all day long because you're not going to feed that bacteria in your gut. It also tells me that that problem, that person has had gut problems from the beginning of their life. And I've had, because that, you know, they didn't feed their critical bifidus bacteria from the beginning because they were, and then if the mother has the SNP and she doesn't have that sugar in her breast milk, she didn't feed the baby either. So that tells me, because I know how important those early beginning days are, that tells me something really important about that person. So every one of these genes has a very fascinating story like that around it. HNMT is histamine, and I gotta change that DAO. There's the new, so now they have new letters for DAO, and the DAO, the reason they did that because there's another DAO SNP, it has more to do with schizophrenia and all. Bipolar and everything, so I need to change that. I wish I could think of the name of it off the top of my head, but I'm like, my head's like not working right too well right now. Okay, so detoxification, hugely important bucket. Now, here's another thing I've got kind of on my soapbox about, and that's that We make a ton of toxins internally, endogenous toxins. So I'm always hearing, every time I hear somebody's, you know, their detox diet or their this, whatever, they don't talk about these endogenous toxins. And they're way more of a problem because we're making them all the time. And they absolutely need to be something that you're on the lookout for when you're looking at these genes. So again, I don't know if acetaldehyde, as I mentioned, is major one produced by candida. If you've ever had alcohol, the alcohol is supposed to be excreted into the urine. The acetaldehyde breaks down and is excreted through the urine, and we're supposed to get rid of it. But imagine if you have this, and it's a brain toxin. So imagine if you've got yeast in your body, and they're making this brain toxin all the time, 24 hours a day. Then that's a very important, like the kyolic garlic. It's excellent to take for bringing down acetaldehyde levels in the body. But you know, if the person has candida, you know they have acetaldehyde, and that's a toxin you want to address. Then you know, excess glutamate. We need glutamate, or we won't be intelligent. People with high levels of glutamate are very smart. But the body is all set up so that the GAD gene, GAD1, breaks that glutamate down into GABA. Well, I see a lot of people with variants there. So they're not breaking their glutamine down to GABA, so they're full of anxiety, they're super intelligent, they can't relax, they can't sleep very well. So, you know, again, there's a fix for all of this, by the way. Homocysteine, of course, has got to be eliminated. It's the homocysteine methionine is the methylation, but it goes down through the other pathway, the transsulfuration pathway, where CBS is there, and then it's eliminated from the body. But so you know, I don't know how much time I have, but let's see. Okay, so really important to look at for these genes are the CYP450, and these are the ones in the liver. So everybody I think knows about phase one, where the toxins enter the body from the outside or they're made in the body from inside. And then in phase one, and hormones and all that, poor liver, I don't even know how it survives really, but you know, in phase one, those toxins are broken apart and they're dangerous. They're more dangerous usually at that stage. But that's okay, because phase two comes along and uses glutathione or amino acids, or, you know, one of the phase two, the body uses phase two to glomp onto those. And then, because the liver is also making bile, it puts those the toxins into the bile, and they're stored in the gallbladder. So that's really phase three, is the making of bile and putting the toxins in there where they're stored. And then there's another phase, because as soon as you eat, the bile drops down into the small intestine. It helps digest fats, for example. And then it goes, now it's in the gut, right? It's in the intestine, so it's moving on down into the colon. And if you don't detoxify there, another person stays constipated, then there's phase four not working right. That's why I'm a very big believer of enemas and colonics. And Elfrida, who's here, was my colon therapist at one time, and she's an outstanding colon therapist, one of the best in the country. There's a lot of colon therapists, and they're not trained very well. But I think coffee enemas are good for increasing glutathione and helping to open the bile ducts, but they don't need to be used very often. But done properly, colonics are amazing and very, very valuable for not aging, too. So some of the really beautiful people that you see in California that are aging amazingly well, they do colonics. But, you know, it's not something anyone talks about. I'm thinking very seriously about doing a whole entire webinar or two, maybe a two or three-part webinar on colonics, because no one wants to talk about that. Some people will never get well if they're not cleaning their colon. And it's like getting on the escalator. You know, you're running to the airport, you want to get to the gate, and then all of a sudden you see this moving escalator. So you're going to walk anyway, but it's moving you faster. That's what colonics are like. And if you can't do colonics, at least start with enemas, with implants afterwards. So another whole conversation in and of itself. So more detox genes, your glutathione genes. If you have COMP, there's our good friend COMP, like so many of our ancestors passed this gene on to us. You can't clear estrogen. And then when you look at your genes that are telling you if you have problems with producing estrone, the wrong kind that will cause cancer, and you've got this gene and you can't clear that estrone, then that person's really more at risk for breast or prostate cancer. By the way, colonics, doing things to move the lymph, like I'm a big fan of the Bellicon rebounder. You know, I think that's a great thing to rebound. That moves the lymph. This keeps these toxins moving out of the body, but I forgot what I was going to say about that, but you know, I'm sorry, I forgot what I was going to say. I'm so worried about getting this through this. Here are the genes for detoxification of hormones, the key ones. So there's, the 1B1 is the one that puts you at risk for getting prostate or breast cancer, because that's about, does your estrogen break down properly into a metabolite that's healthy, or does it break down into a metabolite that's called estrone that's going to cause the breast or prostate cancer? Oh, that's what I was going to say. People who do clonics don't get breast or prostate cancer. You keep the colon clean and healthy, you're not going to get, so the lymph system's right there, and then it gets on up into the prostate and the breast, and you just stay real clean. You know, you have healthy breast tissue, healthy prostate tissue. So 1B1 is a real important one to look at, and then the protective one is 1A1. So let's say you have SNPs in both of them, then and COMP, which is so common, then your risk for cancer. And by the way, I've looked a lot at people's BRCA genes. That gene is so common. But you would make, the media has made us think that if you have those genes, and I see it in men and in women, that you should have your breasts removed or whatever. That's crazy because, again, that's more the epigenetic part of it, but it's a really common gene. So if you got told you have BRCA, well, so does tons of other people, and they don't have cancer ever. Until about 40 years ago, many people had BRCA, and nobody got cancer. So clearly the only thing that's changed is our lifestyle and our diet and so on. 3A4 is also protective. And these play a role in synthesis of cholesterol, which is important for making healthy hormones. And these genes, all these CYP450 genes, are found in the liver. But they're not just in the liver, as you would maybe have been told. They are also in mitochondria and other cells throughout the body. My little cursor keeps disappearing on me. Oh, there it is, sneaking around over there. One of the most important reasons for looking at the CYP450 genes is because they do the real work when it comes to drug metabolism. And I have known two people, maybe three people even, that committed suicide because they were on antidepressants, which they didn't even need to be, but they can't, and they had the CYP2D6, which was determined at autopsy. And so what happens is with these CYP genes, they're either upregulated, or in other words, they move. Here, I think the next slide tells you better. So the CYP450 enzymes are about drug metabolism. So if it's not working very efficiently, then you're taking this drug and it's building up and up and up and up. Like with these friends that I know, they took the antidepressant, and then about 4 months, they built up more and more and more. Then they start getting thoughts in their mind, crazy thoughts, not when they're with people, but when they're alone. And they do crazy things like hang themselves or pick up a gun when they just were talking about 2 hours ago with their son because he had bought tickets for a cruise. So, and then people say, what happened? Well, this is what happened. You know, the crazy thoughts began to take over, and they do crazy things. So this is the most important reason, the hormones and then this whole drug thing, clearing drugs. If it's a variant where the CYP450 is working fast, then the person's taking something, let's say they're taking Wellbutrin, and they're taking it, nothing's happening. Why? Because they're clearing it out so fast that dosage wasn't a good amount for them. So this is like where medicine is going to fine-tune what they're doing. I think we'll see a lot of improvement there. So caffeine is the CYP1A2 gene, and it's a really fun gene to look at in people, because if people have two A's, or minus on your report, they are fast metabolizers of caffeine. And when you see those studies about how beneficial caffeine is, it is to these people. They can have more than one cup a day even. But so if you have one variant on AC, you're medium caffeine, like one cup in the morning is good. If you're a slow metabolizer of coffee, you can still have a little bit, but you're going to degrade it very slowly, like hold it into your body for a really long time. So definitely don't take it close to bedtime. And the other thing, two things, like let's say a woman's pregnant, she doesn't want caffeine. Let's say there's adrenal fatigue happening, and a person, drinks the coffee every morning to get awake, and then they crash, or they drink some more. That person is constantly depleting their adrenals because they're not getting to the root cause of why they have adrenal fatigue to begin with, and they're living off of coffee. So, it's interesting to find look at this. So the ones that are, two A's or AC, they're going to tend to drink more coffee. A lot of times, people that are CC, the slow metabolizers, have already decided, I don't drink coffee. I don't feel good on it. I get real wired and shaky when I drink it. And caffeine isn't just in coffee. It's in chocolate, too. Cocoa and chocolate and cacao and so on. But it's active. So these genes, like let's say you are a slow metabolizer, you have two variants there, then if you eat cruciferous vegetables, they will help that gene work more efficiently, faster, clear. And then if you've got the slow metabolizer gene and you take turmeric, peppermint, chamomile, dandelion, St. John's wort, you're going to inhibit that even more so. So these inhibitors, cofactors, they're important to look at. And then again, these drugs. This gene isn't just about caffeine. It's about drugs, too. So the glutathione genes are part of the detoxification bucket. Just real quickly, I think you know that glutathione is Mother Nature's antioxidant, and we can't detoxify. It's so important. I'm a huge fan on glutathione IV drips. Huge. I've seen miracles happen. If you are you or anyone you know is beginning to get a cataract, amazing. Or lung infection. See, we have a natural bronchodilator in our lungs that's made of glutathione and another molecule. But so people with lung conditions, they should be on these IV drips. Because I don't think you can, glutathione doesn't last very long in the body, so if you get the drip, it's not going to be in your body very long, but it helps a lot while you're getting the drip until it degrades and wears away. But you can take supplements like liposomal glutathione, NAC, of course, and those that's a good thing to do, but there's nothing as powerful as actually getting the glutathione drip. It's very critical in helping your immune system do its job of fighting infections and preventing cancer. Integral part of detoxification. And so toxins are sticking to that glutathione in phase two, getting put into the body and then getting escorted out. Anyway, let me just go to the next slide real fast. If you have high levels of glutathione, those are the people that are going to live longer well. You don't want to just live longer and everybody you know is gone. That's a terrible thing. You want to live long, and you want everyone around you that you love to live a long time. And so that's why it's frustrating when your kids don't eat healthy. But anyway, you do want until the last day that you live on this earth to be feeling great, really. Maybe just go to sleep one night and don't wake up. So here's the GSTM1, one of the most important glutathione genes, and you if it's null, that's where the problem is. You have decreased glutathione levels, and then there's a little handful of glutathione genes, but one of them is GSR, which stands for glutathione reductase. This is the gene that, So glutathione is pretty cool. It recycles itself, and it recycles vitamin E and vitamin C, these other antioxidant genes, which if they didn't get recycled by glutathione, they would become free radicals. So vitamin C can be a free radical. And then, does that mean I have 1 minute? Is that a 1 minute signal? Oh, so sorry. Anyway, so here's foods and things and glycine. Oh, gosh, I wish I had time to talk to you all about oxalates. You have to learn about oxalates. You have to learn how dangerous they are. You have to realize that yeast are producing them in your body all the time. They come from our diet, and there are many, many things happening in the genes where oxalates are being produced. There's even a lot of genes for oxalates. Glycine, which is really important because it's one of the amino acids that makes up, and a lot of people are taking bone broth and all for the glycine. If you have SNPs and you have candidiasis and so on, and you're eating a high oxalate diet, like spinach, nuts and seeds, chocolate, sweet potato, beets. Beets are super high in oxalates. If you ferment them, you get rid of the oxalates. So you want to eat fermented beets because they are great for increasing nitric oxide. But glycine creates oxalates in the body. And glycine, you know, a lot of these things, spinach, you know, beets, chocolate and all that, you know, people are eating them saying they're so healthy for you, but not if you're have issues with oxalates. So please learn about archaea, learn about oxalates. These are maybe new things you haven't heard about before, but on your own, go learn all you can about them because they are playing a huge role in people getting well or not getting well or getting sick and all, and you have to know these things. You have to know them. Five more minutes? Tony, I didn't hear you. Okay, I'm just trying to think. Let me just skip through some really important things. Methylation is an important part of detoxification. And the NRF2 gene, which you'll hear a lot about, is really critical for something called autophagy, where the body goes in while we're sleeping at night and goes to these cells, and it takes material that's so good inside the cells and recycles it. So that's a super important thing that's happening inside of our body. And NRF2 is a really important gene to test for that. And it affects thousands of other genes. And it's also about getting heavy metals out of the body. And it's about sulforaphane. Sulforaphane is the molecule that activates the NRF2 enzyme or gene. And that's what you find in your cruciferous vegetables, but only if they're raw. If you ferment them or you cook them, you do not make sulforaphane. So that's why when you have a smoothie in the morning, it's great to put in a kale leaf. Now, curly kale is really high in oxalates, but the flat kale is not. So put a little bit of a cruciferous vegetable raw in your smoothie. Maybe eat, like a coleslaw, even like shredded cabbage, and put a healthy, I like the Primal Kitchen ranch. You know, Primal Kitchen is Mark Sasson's. He's a paleo guy. That's a delicious salad dressing that you can just buy right on the market. It has avocado oil in it. So you can shred up some cabbage, mix a little bit of that in there, and now you're getting, what happens is you've got two myrinase and glucoraphanin in the cabbage, let's say, your cruciferous vegetables. And they're separate, like, apart until you crush them, blend them, chew them, whatever, and then they blend together, and that's where sulforaphane comes from. And that is an extremely critical molecule to know about. So in the diet program, in our bucket for diet, we talk about genes, we look at oxalates, we look at those genes, we talk about the sulfur. You know, some people are real sensitive to sulfur, but you don't want to cut sulfur out altogether. You don't want to completely avoid onions and garlic and, you know, completely go on this low sulfur diet, or you'll, next thing you know, you'll have a heart attack. Like protein requirements. Okay, I gotta go. I gotta skip one. Hold on just a second. Let me just. Okay, protein. Boy, what a controversial subject. Like, this study says the people with low protein live longer. These people say, as you get older, low protein diet's really dangerous because you get older, you need to have more protein. Ironically, that's true, but the person can't digest protein when they get older because they've lost their stomach acid. So, there's all kinds of fixes for that. So anyway, so there's all this confusing information about protein. But so protein, so if you, let's see, if you don't digest your protein, you end up making ammonia. That's really bad. But in the urea cycle, or the it's also called the ATP or the Krebs cycle, ammonia is made there too. And so looking at all those, there's only six of them, but the six urea cycle or Krebs cycle or ATP cycle, looking at those genes are really important to look at to see if that person should be having protein or not, how much to protein. So these little genes, everything with this little square, those are your urea cycle proteins. Now, you don't have to know all this because we have all this in a software program that you can use. But so here they are again. So if people have SNPs there, they are going to make ammonia from their protein. So they got to be really careful about the kind of protein they eat and how much of it to take. And that's where I like to use the 80-20 rule, 80% vegetables, 20% protein, and fermented foods, because they help break your protein down and prevent, they help prevent the ammonia buildup in the gut. So let me just skip over that. See, I'm trying to think. Okay, what else can I tell you about? One thing for sure, all these people that can take high protein diets, they're athletes. And a whole lot of the studies that are done on protein are done on athletes. So yes, they can get away with a lot of protein, but there's a lot of us that can't. And you don't want a high protein diet, but you very well need a protein. So this is a gene, TCF7L2. This is a real important gene for telling your risk for diabetes. So I mentioned earlier that I have a lot of diabetes genes, and I don't eat sugar, but I have a lot of stress just because that's my personality. And I take on too much. I create a lot of stress for myself. And so what happens is my cortisol goes up, which then elevates my glucose. So I have elevated blood sugar, not because I ate sugar, but because of the stress. So I really have to, with these genes, watch stress, or I could be insulin resistant, develop diabetes if I didn't know better. So I've got to skip all this. So really, really important, because there's all this information about fats out there. That whole argument, all your top brilliant people, they're saying be ketogenic. No, absolutely not. Here are five genes right here you want to look at. I have an article on my website. You can go and read more about this. But the APOE8, the APOA2, the APOA5, the APOE4 that Rita Marie was just talking about, they can't have saturated fats. That gene is also a risk for cardiovascular disease, but people with that gene cannot have saturated fats. They need to get their fats right out of their diet, mostly from eating fish, olive oil. They can't have much fat, period. So the FAB2, that's an interesting gene, because you and I can have lunch together, and I'm eating this same meal, the same fat, but I'm absorbing a whole bunch more of that fat than you are. So that's a factor. And then finally, FTO, which is the one when you eat fat, you get fat. Yeah. So FAD, I'm sure tomorrow Rita Marie's going to go into this.
We're going to go into a lot of detail on a lot of these. But yeah. you've added some extra.
Let me just show you this one, because this is a really fascinating gene. I'd love to check this one. No, seriously. So should everybody eat tons of plants? Not if they have this gene. It's fairly common. It's called the ABCG8. ABCG8. What that means is that when people eat plant foods, plants have fats in them too. They're called sterols. There's cholesterol and there's sterols. People with this gene, they get so sick when they eat plants.
Plants or plant fats?
Or vegetable oils, nuts and seeds, oats, wheats, avocados, for example. They think they're doing all this really healthy stuff, but not with this gene. And the symptoms would be achy, painful joints. That's the same as the oxalates. Okay, I'll stop there.
Thank you.
Frustrating. Anyway, sorry.
This was great. You offered some really great.
So our gene
stuff.
Is called Butterfly Genomics, our app. And if you're interested in knowing more about it,
Will you be here till tomorrow?
Later.
Are you going to stay?
No, I have to leave at 11 in the morning.
Oh, okay.
So if you want to talk to
so
me,
so they can go to the site.
Talk
catch
to me
Donna
tomorrow.
Tonight. Catch her. Yeah. You know. Body Ecology,
Here it is.
.com, right?
Because I'm going to start giving courses in the butterfly genomics starting in the winter.
The slides will be on the site. They may already be there. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, good.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much. This was awesome.
Thank you.
Awesome stuff. Thanks.